Today, I want to try something a little different. I want us to think about the first word that comes to mind when we hear the following phrase. Free association here. Don't overthink it. Just what do you think of when I say these words? Unaccompanied alien child. Unaccompanied alien child, UAC. So I'll start. I'm Sarah, and the first word that comes to my mind when I hear that phrase is scared. Anybody want to start? Yeah.
Carol, and my word was fear.
Same fear. Thing, but okay. Fear. Thank you, Carol.
Annette, I think abandonment.
Abandonment, yeah.
Neil.
Oh. Okay.
Neil, I think forlorn.
Forlorn, thank you.
Lola, and I'd say frightened.
Lola. Thanks.
Feeling
alone. That's all right.
David, concerned.
Concerned. Thanks, David.
John, crime.
Crime. Thanks.
Sharon, that's the word I had to, crying.
Crime. Oh, crying?
Crying.
Crying. Did you say crime or crying?
Crime.
Crime and crying. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And suffering.
Suffering. Thanks.
Kathy, crying.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dennis. Brave.
Brave. Thanks.
Madeline.
Frightened.
Frightened.
Wayne. Lost.
Lost. Thanks.
Melinda. Misunderstood.
Misunderstood. Thanks.
Zora. Frightened.
Sorry, what was your name?
Zora. Frightened.
Zora. Frightened. Thank you.
Bye. My word was scary.
Scary. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah. Beth. Determined.
Determined. Thanks. A couple more folks.
Ruth, abandonment.
Abandonment. Anybody else who hasn't gone? Or wants to? Okay. Thank you. All right. So, as I mentioned yesterday, The structure of these sessions is we're going to be exploring a contemporary text or texts alongside a biblical text or text, or texts, plural. So today we are talking about children, about unaccompanied alien children. That is a phrase used by the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement to describe children who cross the border, most often our southwest border, alone, without an adult chaperone, so to speak, with them. So in my work, I met and worked on petitions for many unaccompanied alien children. Yeah, let me
just... Does it include those that have been separated from?
So that's a really good question. I don't know how they're defining that now. I don't think so. I think that...
Could you repeat her question?
Oh, sorry. Her question was, does that phrase include those who are being separated from their families right now? So honestly, I don't know how that's working at the moment. If once a child... It might be true that once a child is separated from their parent, then they officially become a UAC in the eyes of the law.
So,
I don't.
So these children would be a little bit older.
Yeah, so often what we're talking about when we say UACs or unaccompanied alien children are teenagers, young teenagers, often coming from, again, those countries I mentioned in Central America and then many from Mexico as well. Crossing alone. So we're talking like really young, like, I mean, some as young as 12, right, who are making this journey north, and then some as old as 17. Yeah, thank you for that question. And please stop me and ask questions and interrupt me if I'm not talking loud enough throughout the sessions. Yes, So, thanks. I'll just stand over here. So today, our biblical text that we're going to explore is the story of Moses from the beginning of Exodus. And then what we'll start, as we did yesterday, with a contemporary text. So our contemporary text today is going to be a story of a client that I worked with, and of course I'll change names and some details, but I'll share with you. And then we have another text, which is a visual text. It's a map from the Department of Homeland Security that I'll pass out in a moment. But first I'll share with you briefly Fernando's story. His name is not Fernando, but that's the name I'll give him. This is the story of the first person that I interpreted for his asylum interview. So when he went to the asylum office in San Francisco and was interviewed by a lawyer for the government. So they, folks, if any of you have been to an asylum interview or know a little bit about this process, it's the process of requesting refugee status, asylum, in this country. So folks who are coming here and say, I cannot return to my country for fear of being persecuted for a number of reasons. So it's that process.
Would you just step over so she could?
Oh, sure.
No. Okay, what I thought it was is this, but it's plugged in.
Oh, I think it's okay. Yeah, thanks. I'll just, if I hear it again, I'll move around or I'll just take this off if it gets too bad. So yes, in order to request asylum, you need to go before a government official who asks you a series of questions. It can take anywhere from an hour to 3 hours. I've heard of some going longer if they're very suspicious of your story or have more questions. So this was the first person I interpreted for his interview. And Fernando is from Honduras. And he was 17 when he came here. And he was 17 at the interview because he presented himself. He got his interview scheduled about 6 months after he entered. And so he was living in a small town in Honduras and started to get recruited by the gangs there. So they tried to recruit him, I should say. So they told him, you know, you need to come join us. And he said no. He's a pretty devout Catholic. And his parish priest had been vocal trying to help kids stay out of gangs, right, and vocal against the gangs. So that was even more reason for him to be targeted. So they asked him again. And he said no, and they would wait like at along the road from he would walk 2 miles to school. So walking home from high school, they would wait at one of the places where he would walk by, and then they would talk to him and tell him and threaten him. Anyway, he eventually got too scared, and he ended up moving. His uncle had an apartment in the capital, in Tegucigalpa. So he ended up moving to the capital in this like little apartment, right, that his uncle owned. So he was there alone. His parents were back in their small hometown, but they said, yeah, you got to get out of here. It's not safe for you here. Gang members ended up coming to his apartment, his uncle's apartment, this little tiny apartment, and threatening him. They beat him up. And they threatened him with a screwdriver. And I remember that very clearly because I could not remember the word for screwdriver when I was interpreting in the interview. And it was, I just could not remember. And I'm describing to the asylum officer, you know, the like, the metal thing, and it's pointy, and it's, and you know, and when you interpret for asylum interviews, this is a side, you don't have to be a court-certified interpreter. And so someone can bring a family member, for example, to interpret for them. But DHS the federal government contracts with certified interpreters who listen in via a speakerphone. And so that's there. So if you interpret well, they're just quiet. They don't say anything. But if you make a mistake, like if you have a family member who is interpreting for you and maybe like changes the detail of your story, because like maybe they know the story and maybe whatever, then like this like disembodied voice comes out of the speakerphone and is like, excuse me, that was wrong. So I remember very clearly that he had been threatened with a screwdriver because I'm like, you know, the thing, da 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 da. And this disembodied voice goes, screwdriver. Oh, duh. Okay. So anyway, that was my first experience interpreting. Anyway, so Fernando had been threatened, and finally he decides, I can't do it anymore. And his parents, he talks to his parents on the phone, and they're like, yeah, you gotta go north. Like, there is, you know, you already moved once, they found you there, go. We'll send you some money and just do it. You know, there we have a distant relative, I think it was like a second cousin of his mom, who lived in California. So go and try and connect with her. Okay, so his mom sends him money, and he makes the journey. So he gets on the train. Some of you may have heard, they call it the Beast or La Bestia. It's the freight trains that go north. Many refugees who are trying to get to Mexico and then to the States will hop on the side of these massive freight trains and use that to get north. So it's extremely dangerous. So hop on, grab onto the side of the train, and then ride it as long as they can. So that was Fernando's story. So he came, he eventually crossed the border. He did not present himself at the border asking for asylum. He came through and was able to get in without papers. I try not to say illegally, because what does that mean? But anyway, he crossed in the eyes of Jeff Sessions illegally, right? So he eventually connected with his relative, and then was here. And then he eventually got found out, had a deportation order, and then began his asylum process. So that's what's called defensive asylum. Affirmative asylum is when you don't have a deportation order and you present yourself right away and you're not, immigration law jargon. Yes?
If there's an interpreter sitting there behind the screen, why don't they just interpret?
So they're sitting in their home somewhere in Wyoming or Texas, and they're just calling in. And I think, you know why? I think they don't just interpret, because then the government doesn't have to pay them as much, because they're just monitoring. They would have to be paid a lot more if they were actually going to do the interpreting. Yes. So that's Fernando's story. So Fernando is a UAC, an unaccompanied alien child. Yes.
Plus, from a mental health point of view, if they're not in the room and they aren't watching the person and the demeanor, they're not emotionally involved. And so, they're much less involved.
Sure.
So, you know, I can't do therapy, for example, over the phone with somebody. I've got to be with them.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting about that is that the interpreter who's in the room is also supposed to be not emotionally involved, which is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you interpret better because you can see body language and you can watch mouth moving. So maybe if like you didn't hear it quite right, you know the word they said. But it's very challenging. I mean, this was my first experience doing this, and I wanted to weep, but you can't, or you're not supposed to. And I had many more experiences like that, which is part of the reason I stopped doing that.
And it might make for a friendlier opportunity, perhaps, for the young person to be with someone they feel a little more comfortable with than a
sure
federal official.
Yeah, yeah. And depending on the federal official, the asylum officer who's doing the interview, they can be fairly friendly. And I had experiences where it was clear there was empathy there, or they can be extremely cold. Yeah. And even if they have empathy, the questions that they have to ask are the same, and they're there to do their job, which is to make the person trip up on their story so that they can be discredited. And they can say, oh, you don't have a credible fear of going home. You can go in. So, yeah. So that's our first contemporary text for the day. And now I'm going to hand out, if you could pass these around, I think we're going to be short a couple, so some folks might need to share. This is a map from the Department of Homeland Security, and it's what they call Border Patrol Apprehension Data. This is from 2014. 2014, you might remember, that was when a huge explosion of young folks coming, especially from Central America, as you'll see on this map, were coming over the border. There was a surge in gang violence at that time, and so a ton of kids were coming without their parents. So this map, I tried to blow it up so you can see it better, but it shows the number of UACs by location of origin. So it's a map of those Northern Triangle countries and showing how many, so where these kids are coming from, right? So you can see the most, what was at the time and maybe still is, the most dangerous city in the world, again, including Syria, including places that are actively at war, was a city called San Pedro Sula in Honduras. And so the largest number of kids, that's the biggest circle on the map, largest number of kids, thanks. Right. Are being apprehended at the border by customs and border patrol are coming from there. So that, again, this is from 2014, and you want to take a look at that. Yes?
So, in fact, in that influx of all those young people, uh-huh. Would you feel like that a lot of those were in fact gang members also? That were
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I think yes, that was a fear for sure. So I think in many ways the US government viewed many of these UACs not as determined or as frightened or as abandoned, some of the words that came up when we introduced ourselves, but as threats, as dangerous. As threatening and as taking over. So, exactly. So when folks were getting interviewed, these kids were getting doing their asylum interviews, a lot of the questions were to determine, wait, are you, you're a gang member, you're coming, right.
And was that in fact true? I mean, were there a number of...
There were some, but... I mean, the vast majority were people who were trying to escape that. So whether or not they had even been initiated or not, they were still trying to get away.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. It sounds like Fernando was coming on his own motivation.
It's working?
Sorry. Are people still... I turned her down a little bit, but are people still able to hear her okay?
Yeah.
Okay, I think what was happening is that it was cranked up so loud that it was feeding back with that speaker. So
that
anytime you walked into the track of the speaker, it was bumping. I also have noticed that your beautiful light has gone to red, so I'm going to change batteries for you.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yes, so
are some of them also... kind of, it's their parents saying, "I want you to be safe," and they go. And so
yes.
It seems like if Fernando, for instance, went because he had enough kind of internal motivation and courage
he'd be maybe determined, might be the word, rather than as frightened as a child who is there because their parents really say, I want you to go.
Yeah.
And sends them off on their own.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because some of these kids, their parents are already in the States. So we've all probably met, or maybe have met people who have come here more as economic refugees and are working three jobs and sending money home to their kids, right? So I had some clients who that was the case. So they're in the States, they're working super hard so that they can send money home so that their kids can eat, right? So they're sending money home to their parents. So the kids are being raised by their grandparents, and that's where they're getting the money, right? Well, then maybe the parent really wants their kid to come up here to be with them, right? And maybe the kid isn't experiencing any direct threats, but their parent says, like, I want you here, right? Come live with me. So then maybe the parent pays a coyote, which is a smuggler, who brings the kid up. And maybe the kid is absolutely terrified, because maybe the last time they saw their parents was when they were 3 years old, and now maybe they're 12. And they're having to go on this crazy journey with some guy they don't know, a smuggler, to bring them up north to meet their parents again. And that's exactly right. That some kids, like Fernando was determined to get here. He was like, I gotta get out. His family agreed. And it's not that he wasn't scared, but he kind of took a little agency in that decision as well. And then there are kids who that's just not the case. Yeah. Yes?
Two questions. I'm sorry, you may have covered this yesterday.
No, that's okay.
These are usually boys, I take it. Not
often, yeah. I don't know the exact statistics right now, but often, yes, it was, because it was often boys who were being recruited by gangs. But I also had, like, contact with a lot of young girls who were being recruited in different ways and facing, yeah, and sexual violence. And there's, so a Jaina, that's the name for a gang member's girlfriend, right? Like, his Jaina. I don't know. There isn't really, I don't know a good English word for it. And so young women who were being recruited for that and were like, I don't want that, but maybe this gang member thought they were really pretty and they could be 15 years old, right? And there's, like, a 35-year-old or older gang boss who's like, I want that girl. And so mainly boys, those are the more common stories, but a lot of young women as well.
And could you, can you say anything about what activities the gangs were involved in?
Sure. Yeah, so like the lucrative part of a lot of their work has to do with extortion and moving drugs.
Okay.
So the extortion piece, you could have a whole like area of a town that is controlled by one gang, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that the gang runs everything in that area. So if you own a little shop, maybe you have like in El Salvador, you have a little kiosk where you sell pupusas, which are like cornmeal or rice flour fritters filled with stuff, right? So you have a little shop. A gang member will come to you and say, I'm going to charge your rent. And this month you owe me $100. Or else we'll shut you down. So they would charge rent because they can. And that's what they would call it, la renta, like the rent. So one of the major activities when I'm talking about kids being recruited for gangs, they're being recruited to be the folks who are collecting the rent. So like, they wanted Fernando to join because he was an upstanding young man in the community, so he could go to people, and they thought he had good connections, so they wanted him to charge the rent. Yes.
So when you say gang members, the people that are heading this up, what is the age group of those people? I mean, they're obviously not teenagers.
Some are teenagers.
Oh, some are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely.
But I mean, like the gang bosses, they would be 30s, 40s, or...
Yeah,
but they're
yeah.
still considered gang people.
What do you mean?
I
like,
would think of gang people as like younger, you know, like teenage, early 20s, but...
So, yeah. Well, that's probably about right, because to be honest, the life expectancy of somebody who is involved in that kind of stuff is very low.
Okay.
Many of these people don't expect to make it to 30.
Oh.
Because they'll probably be killed before then. So yes, on the younger end, but not always.
Okay.
This is, it's really heavy.
What happened to Fernando? I mean, now we're waiting for him to
send
back for that.
So the amazing news about Fernando is that this interview that I'm talking about took place in early 2015, which means it was before our current administration. And at that time, the San Francisco Asylum Office was known for being very fair, and especially treating children with compassion. And Fernando had a very credible story, and he was granted asylum. So he's now a permanent resident. Yep.
Do you have to become naturalized, or is that an option?
That's an option for him. Yep, so in about, I'm trying to do the math, in a few years he'll be eligible to apply for his citizenship. That is not the case for many people today. So in talking to my my boss, the lawyer who I used to work for, who was Fernando's lawyer, things have changed so much in the past year and a half. Now, I mean, forget it. If you have an asylum claim and you get an interview, even at the San Francisco office, it's really, really, really likely that it will just be flat out denied.
And so what happens to them when that denial happens? They're just deported across the border into Mexico, or are they transported to the country of origin, or what?
It depends on what their status is at the time. So not everybody applying for asylum has the same legal status or the same documentation at the time that they apply for asylum. It depends on how you do it. It depends on a lot of things. So in some cases, yes, they'll have an order of deportation. And then...
to the country of origin?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So, and in some cases, they'll be allowed to stay for a little bit longer. And they'll have to continue to make report to ICE. Often they'll have an ankle monitor. And then they'll have to do ICE check-ins, so they go and talk to their parole officer if they're, like, on parole. there are a few things.
A little while ago you said, so I've also interpreted for asylum interviews. A little while ago, you mentioned that it's DHS's job to, I forget how you said it, but to basically cause a story to break down so that somebody is denied. And my understanding was that it was their job to determine whether somebody actually had credible fear or not had credible fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, is that a function of administration? Can you just say a little bit more about that statement that you made? Because that sounds to me to be... I mean, I saw that happen, but just, is that something that's articulated?
No. That is, yes, so I, No, officially that was absolutely not their function. Their function is to sit there and to determine whether or not they have a credible story.
Right.
So I did kind of misspeak. I think in reality, their function is to, yes, find holes in the person's story. And hopefully.
Because the numbers are too great. What's correct. The motivation?
Correct, the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The numbers. We don't want any more terrorist refugees coming in. Too many. I mean, that's my experience. And the lawyer who I worked for, that's her experience, and she's been in it for a while. But definitely, you could argue with that for sure. And
so
yeah.
That's not at all like my understanding of what happened to Moses. he was welcome.
So, well, thanks, Dennis, because our scripture for the day is Exodus 1.
Yeah.
I know you knew that. So we're actually going to read Exodus 1, Exodus 1:8 through 2:10. And keeping Fernando's story and that map in our minds as we read this today. Can I get some volunteers who want to help read aloud this story so we can listen in community? Yes, Kathy, Madeline. Okay. Let's, Kathy, if you could read Exodus 1, verses 8 through the end of the chapter, through verse 22. And then Madeline, if you could read chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Yeah, so I'll just invite us to, if you like, if you're listening, to close your eyes and imagine yourself in this story. See what's happening in the story. What are you smelling? What are you feeling? What are you hearing? Or if that doesn't work for you, to follow along in your Bible.
Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Rameses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites, and made their lives bitter and hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw him into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live."
Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and covered it with cinnamon and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw a child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrew children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water."
Thank you. So I'm going to invite us now to get into groups of 3 or 4 and mix it up, or you can just turn to the folks next to you. And I'm going to invite you to explore 2 questions. So the first question is, what connections or disconnections do you find between this ancient text and the contemporary text? The second question is, who are you in this story? You can take a couple moments. If you want to jot down some notes on the back of that map, collect some of your thoughts. And then we'll spend about 7 minutes in our small groups talking about these questions or anything else that comes up for us as we're sitting with these stories. Awesome. So in that case, I would love to hear some of what you talked about. So if maybe one person from each group can elect a spokesperson to share with the larger group just a couple key things, maybe what was most impactful in your group as you talked with one another. Who wants to start?
You're our person.
You've been elected.
Okay.
And if you can say your name again, too, before you. Yeah.
I'm Beth. And our group, we talked about mostly the question of the similarities and dissimilarities. And so saw similarities in the I'll say dissimilarities. Dissimilarities are that, I can't remember. So
that's okay. I'm sure your group will help.
Processed a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But there's certainly that we talked about how, I won't put it in dissimilarities, I'll just say what we talked about. So we talked about how there was a lot of collusion among, it was really a women's story, there was a lot of collusion among the women to help the children. Also, Pharaoh's daughter surely had known, and they must have known, she had to know, and she did know the child was a Hebrew. How did that work out, you know? Also that it was a time in history when borders were not defended in the same way that they are now, and human populations moved. Mm-hmm. To where there was opportunity and need, or where there was pressure here, they would move some elsewhere. And that happened much more naturally. It's almost an unnatural thing to have such rigid border lines and so defended. Mm-hmm. We wondered about the question of if Moses was actually not such an outlier when he crossed over the border because of that movement, he could really move. Also, as a male, he could move more easily. And so I'm really interpreting. Help me out here, Sharon. So what else?
Just mostly, we just talked about the collusion of the women, no matter whose side they were on.
Yeah.
The Pharaoh's daughter is watching to be sure that this baby is, you know, safe. You know, so it's a sort of a collusion of women and lots of respectful disobedience.
Absolutely. Yeah, and about borders and people moving across borders, that's a really good point. And also remember that the Israelites were slaves. So they lived in, like, the slave area, right, in Egypt. So they were in Egypt, but in a way, Moses isn't just crossing a border from, like, slave town to free town.
Right.
He's also crossing a border of being a slave to being, well, now a member of the royal family, right? Really quick thing about Pharaoh's daughter. I just have to say this. So I had this amazing Old Testament professor in seminary who talked about how maybe Moses, and she was this amazing Hebrew scholar, so she did all the Hebrew scholarly work, but that Moses is actually, like, Pharaoh's daughter is the model for Moses. So the name Moses, so at the end she said, I'll call him Moses because I drew him out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
That also means, like, he draws the Israelite people out through the water, out of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So Pharaoh's daughter is this archetype that Moses then like steps into that, which totally blew my mind. Because yes, women. Okay, does another group want to share?
We talked a lot about midwives and the role of a midwife facilitating passage.
Mm-hmm.
And that Moses and have been advocates, and then in contrast to a lot of the undocumented children, unaccompanied children, Who is midwife to them? Who can be advocate for them? And seeing kind of a lack of that. But, you know, are there opportunities to be a participant in that midwifery?
Yes.
That we don't know about. And certainly people who do the role of interpreter
kind of
may or may not, depending, I suppose, on who they are as person, might feel like an advocate, friend, midwife to the person, but how they don't have they lack midwives and they need them.
Yes, well, and a word of hope on that is the offering that was taken at Eucharist on Sunday here was for a group called Kids in Need of Defense, KIND, and that's specifically I was so delighted to see that that's where the offering was going and that I was going to be teaching this class, because that is a nonprofit organization that its sole purpose is to accompany these kids. So check them out.
Yeah.
If you
kids
want
in KIND,
KIND
is the acronym.
KIND is the acronym. KIND. Kids in Need of Defense.
Well, I got separated from my group here. But one of the things that we thought about, that there's fear on both sides.
Yes.
That certainly Fernando has fear, and those like him, and the people who are trying to stop him by the government also have fear, because there'll be too many Fernandos that are coming, and whether a higher percentage in red states versus blue states, except for maybe California, that seems to be pretty well established. But there's fear on both sides.
Yeah, and fear is powerful.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's really powerful. Yeah, thank you. Any other groups want to share before we
Well, we were caught up with the midwives also.
Yes. Such a friend who had their bravery and being disrespectful.
Yep. So
we had a lot of conversation.
Mm-hmm. You know, one comment about the Exodus story is those people were not physically that dissimilar in their looks.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Right, so Moses could, so you're talking about like the Hebrew slaves and the Egyptians. Right, so Pharaoh's daughter could take Moses as a baby and grow up, and it's not like he's walking down the street and they're like, that's a Hebrew, you're a slave. Right. Anybody else?
We did also talk about Pharaoh's daughter, you know, and that, I mean, here she was in direct opposition to what her father was about. So
yep.
She was really a woman of courage.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
How did she pull that off? You know, that was kind of
absolutely.
And yet
she hadn't been pregnant, obviously. You know.
But you know,
she was probably the only woman that could have pulled it off.
Right.
Yeah.
So she used her privilege, right?
Selective denial going on here. So.
Yeah. So that's a really important point. She was probably the only woman who could have pulled it off. So she used her extreme place of privilege. I mean, she was a woman, but we all have multiple identities, right? So she also had a lot of privilege as a royal person, as a princess. And look what she did, what she did with that. I mean, it's pretty powerful.
I think we shouldn't miss the irony with which the story is told, that the story that originates with Joseph, who becomes Pharaoh's right-hand man,
mm-hmm.
now again his people are being brought into Pharaoh's household, becoming part of the story in that way.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a story coming back on itself.
And you can hear that irony right at the beginning, because the first, that in verse 8, now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph.
He
didn't know. He didn't know it was coming.
But he would get to it.
Exactly.
One would think.
Our group had two men and one woman, and I was struck by, when we talked about who do you identify with, it was hard for the men because they had to, they're going to, you know, change gender to identify with the princess. But I love what David said. He said, I would be advisor to the Pharaoh and tell him that these are important people and they should be, you know, would be useful to our society.
He's on the side.
I love that. Find your own place.
And they could help us.
Said,
you know.
Because it was very hard, and I made up, I said, I must be Moses because I'm male. And after it was all done, I said, no, I would be one of the soldiers. You know, I came very close to going to Vietnam and seeing, you know, what would I have done there? And I went to a Lutheran grade school where all of these stories were always, okay now, children, we all have it in us to do the good or the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in these stories, this could be you. Here, you know, always be careful. It could be, you could be,
you could be fair.
You could end up being either way.
Well, I just want to say that, too, the one thing that's hard about this Moses story is that it is so archetypal. And that, you know, it was first told long after the events. And there are a couple of interesting details about that, one of which is that despite excessive searching, no one has ever found a separate slave quarters associated with a building site, a major building site, and that all of so far of the archaeological remains have indicated that people who were workers lived a relatively middle-class life, that they had, they could tell that by their food and so on. So when I, knowing that from that information, it makes me think also about what other parts of that story aren't told. And so I have to wonder, and the story becomes shaped for a certain purpose. But if I look at real human beings and how they behave, I ask myself some other questions. Like, who was Moses' father, who's never named? Was it possible that Moses was the son of an Egyptian, and that when he killed an Egyptian, whoever knew who his father was said, we got to get this kid out of here? And that becomes a different story, you know? So, and pulled some strings, you know?
Yeah, really good question.
I would like to add, too, that I think fear, because there's fear all through this, often leads to anger. And when you look at our government's response today, it seems like it's an angry response to immigrants. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me. But in my mind, Trump is the feral, and he's ordering the death of these children.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
And who will be Pharaoh's daughter?
Yeah. Good question. And you know, it makes me think, there, not that long ago, Jeff Sessions was recorded, or he was, you know, talking somewhere. I think we've maybe seen the, you know, where he's quoting Romans 13 and saying, you know, stop it, all you pastors, saying all that Bible stuff about against family separation. You know, really, let me quote this verse, and you should obey the law. So we've seen that. But he's also said, well, you know, these parents are the ones sending their kids over the border to put them in harm's way, and they're breaking the law. And that really strikes me. Anyway, I first, like, made the connection between these texts when I was at a vigil outside one of the detention centers in California. We do these monthly vigils, and someone had a sign that the interfaith vigils, a sign that said, it had a picture of the basket and the reeds, and it said, Moses' mother sent him to freedom too.
Say that again.
It said, Moses' mother sent him to freedom too. And I went, oh my God, Moses is anywhere to see. I never saw it. Anyway, that's that. I know we need to get out of here. So I'm going to close us in prayer. And we didn't get to the video again today, but I promise we will. It's a very hopeful video. I have some more. And we will. And I promise maybe we'll start with it tomorrow.
Okay. We'll hold you.
Okay. Yeah. You just need to. Yeah. Okay, the Lord be with you. Let us pray. Loving God, Spirit of all things, we give you thanks for this morning, for this day, for the opportunity to dialogue with one another, to find ourselves in ancient stories, to be inspired, to be angry, to be moved, and pray that you would bless us this day and always. Amen.
Amen.